This talk is offered by Ordinary Mind Zendo. Ordinary Mind was founded by Barry Magid, Dharma heir of Charlotte Joko Beck, and is dedicated to her vision of a psychologically minded Zen practice adapted to the needs of American students practicing in the context of their everyday lives. Our public programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
This morning, I'd like to read a little imaginary dialogue between the Buddha and David Hume, as presented in Existential Comics, which is a wonderful series that somehow occasionally shows up on Facebook. It's like this one. It creates little cartoon dialogues between different philosophers to illustrate their positions and sometimes reveal their absurdities. In any case, as you know, Hume is often compared to the Buddha in terms of his theories of the self, where he claimed that self was a bundle of experience without any permanent I or me in the background that organized it all. And so he's often been considered a kind of Western counterpart to Buddhist thinking. And so this comic imagines a dialogue between the two of them to illustrate this. So the Buddha begins, "You see, Hume, when you examine yourself closely, you find there is no such thing as yourself." Hume replies, "I couldn't agree more, Buddha. We have a bundle of experiences, but no transcendent thing which exists beyond that." Buddha says, "Yesterday a tree existed, and a tree was experienced, and today a glass exists, and a glass is experienced." He's holding up a glass, they're sitting in a bar together. But this vanity that we call I is nowhere to be found. "I couldn't have said it better myself," says Hume. "I've never met anyone whose ideas were so in sync with my own." And the Buddha says, "But the question is, Hume, what should be done as a consequence of this realization?" Hume, "I have a feeling we have the same answers. Let's say it together on the count of three. Ready? One, two, three." And the Buddha says, "Turn away from sensual pleasure and earthly passions into contemplation." And Hume says, "Pursue only sensual pleasure and passions over reason." And so Hume is flabbergasted that they've come to opposite conclusions. And says, "Yeah, what? What?" Buddha, "Well, since sensual pleasures are fleeting and passions are illusionary, we should not pursue them." Hume, "No, since senses are the only thing that exist, that's all we should pursue, and reason should be a slave to the passions." Buddha, "Why pursue something that is gone as soon as you get it?" Hume, "All right, you're not nearly as awesome as I thought. Let's at least get some drinks and talk to women." Buddha, "I don't do any of those things." "Well, I've never met anyone whose ideas were so out of sync with my own," concludes Hume. So, it's a nice way to illustrate the apparent congruence between their ideas, but the quick divergence about the consequences. That in itself reflects a famous idea of Hume's, that you cannot conclude an ought from an is. That means that if you give a factual description of the way things are, that has no compelling reason to conclude anything about the way things ought to be. That the way they ought to be is an emotional response to the way things are, and that has no absolute basis in logic or reason or an empirical description of things. Hume sort of seen as the beginning of this kind of emotive theory of ethics, that we are basically simply giving our approval to one state of things over another, but that isn't grounded in anything absolute, particularly nothing absolute like religion. Hume, like Adam Smith, wanted to ground ethics in what was called sentiment, or fellow feeling, or what we would call empathy, that our feeling response to other people's suffering is the basis of our morality. It's not something that we arrive at by reason. It's not something we can universalize as a set of principles the way Kant tried to do. But it's an emotional response to life, and that there's nothing more foundational or bedrock than those emotions. So Hume says that our emotions, our feelings, are what give us motivation and direction, and our reason simply creates means to those ends, but the ends are a product of our feeling, not our reason. Now, the main lesson I would like to draw from this is that in our practice, if we are honest about it, we are much closer to Hume than we are to Buddha. Both of them say something about the nature of the self, but they draw different conclusions. And Buddha's conclusion here is a conclusion of non-attachment and asceticism as a response to impermanence. And Hume's response is one of acceptance of impermanence, but basically a willingness to simply go with the flow of impermanence and enjoy the ride. Okay? Hume's attitude to life in this regard in that period, in the 18th century, was a kind of combination of the skeptical and the Epicurean. He was skeptical in that he kept undermining our certainty of things like the self and causality, which is another big difference between him and Buddha that the cartoon doesn't touch on. Buddha, of course, is very big on karma and causality. Hume thought causality was simply something we inferred from the probability of things happening, but we weren't really discerning any actual causes. But like the Epicureans, one of Hume's basic projects was to free people from superstitious religion. He wrote against proofs of God and the belief in miracles or immortality. And he was quite a scandalous figure for that reason at the time. Adam Smith got himself in a little bit of trouble when Hume died by publishing an account of Hume's death as characterized by you know, there was a very peaceful death, a human contemplated dying with great equanimity and no concern at all for an afterlife or judgment. And people were scandalized. There was a deep-seated feeling that conventional morality depended on religion and a belief in the afterlife and judgment, and without that, the whole moral foundation of society would collapse. Hume seemed to have no requirement for any of that in order to live a perfectly sane and decent and peaceful life. The other thing that's interesting in a way you can think about Hume and Buddha is that they tied their sense of impermanence to a deep reliance on tradition. Even though everything is impermanent, Buddhism sets up forms and practices and institutions as a kind of relatively unchanging, ongoing container of practice. Hume, like Burke, was someone who believed in freedom and was critical of monarchies for oppressing people, but felt that the only thing that held society together was basically habit and tradition. He thought there's no abiding self, but we cultivate, sort of like Aristotle, we cultivate virtues, we develop character, and morality and convention are a matter of habit. And so for him, maintaining the orderliness of society was sort of synonymous with maintaining virtue. So like Burke, he was no fan of revolution. He didn't think you could wipe the slate clean and use reason as a way to imagine an ideal society that you would build from scratch on logical grounds. He thought that that was vastly overestimating the capacity of reason. So there's an interesting way in which both traditions are on the one hand radically skeptical, and on the other hand deeply conservative and traditional. We're not used to thinking that those things go together. But once you eliminate a kind of divine or transcendent sense of an order to the universe, the only order is the one that you create here and now. And both of them were very involved in thinking about the kind of orderly life we need for ourselves, whether that's Buddha in the rules of the Vinaya for monasticism, or somebody like Dogen, you know, creating all the rules of monastic life. There's a very powerful conservative sense that these traditions are what make for a good life. But again, I would say we have to be honest, as particularly as lay people in the West, that we're not aspiring to or trying to replicate ascetic detachment, as the fruit of our realization. We basically don't think that non-attachment means home leaving and no possessions, and the renunciation of physical pleasure or desire, and sexuality, family, and relationship. Like Hume, I want to have a drink and talk to women. And I don't think that that is, in some sense, abnegation or repudiation of real Buddhism, but it's a reformulation of our relationship to impermanence and attachment within the midst of everyday life. And I think that's a crucial aspect of what's happening to Buddhism in the West, that non-attachment doesn't mean renunciation. It means a willingness to let go of control, a willingness to live with the reality of impermanence without an attempt to instrumentalize everything or get absolute possession or control of it. It's a psychologizing of our notions of attachment and detachment. See, however, even here there is this conservative element that says the form and the tradition and the discipline are the container of practice. And because lay life offers the competing dilemma of secularization, instrumentalization, commodification, and sort of endless compulsive self-improvement. For me, keeping practice in the religious column is a way to create an alternative to that, to make discipline or about presence rather than about improvement, right? About it's not about getting from here to there, it's about somehow actually being willing to stay where you are and stay in the midst of your actual experience. But the lives we want to live are much more like Hume's than Buddha's. And I think it's important that we recognize that, not shy away from that, and not think that somehow we are not the real thing because of it. That's the transformation that's happening now, and I think we should be clear about it and our place in it.